Hello, I'm Kathleen Dunn. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Monday, the 11th of May. And our guest this hour is the Washington Bureau Chief for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. Craig Gilbert is joining us. We have a lot to talk about. He had a front page story yesterday on job loss in Kenosha and outrage and anguish on the part of just about every Democrat and Republican representing the state of Wisconsin in Washington. We'll look at health care, where the administration and industry groups are going to be proposing $2 trillion in health care savings. That should take place, that meeting sometime today, and a number of other issues for us to look at. Nearly 540,000 jobs lost in April, the unemployment rate going up to 8.9%, and yet the news spin on this is that the loss wasn't as severe as people thought it was going to be, so it is a good sign. How could it be a good sign? We'll be welcoming phone calls, as we always do. Our phone number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. And if you would like to send an email, that's talk@WPR.org. Craig, hello. Thank you so much for being with us.
Good morning.
Hi. Let's start with yesterday's front page story. We did a show on this last week. We got bipartisan support here that jobs shouldn't be leaving Kenosha, right?
Yeah, I think, I mean, that part of it is pretty predictable, obviously, to have, you know, people on both sides of the aisle from Wisconsin, you know, and also the governor and everybody else up and down the line agitating about this, outraged about it, trying to do something about it. I'm not sure how great the prospects are for doing much about the Chrysler decision, but the whole, I think, the whole set of developments is really underscores some of the political dilemmas and complexities when the government, rescues a company like this and begins to sort of cooperate the company.
Right. And the president said in his administration he can't micromanage these companies, but there is huge outrage, as you know, when they leave some Mexican plants open and open one and then close a place like the Kenosha facility. It just creates outrage. This is taxpayer money, right?
Yeah, and it's, you know, there's certainly an appearance problem here. Now, what the Obama people will argue is that in the case of Kenosha, this is the product of a bunch of decisions that were made some time ago. The Mexico plant that people are upset about is now largely built and is about to come online. So it's not, I guess what they would argue is there's a difference between prospectively looking ahead and saying, you know, build this product in America instead of, you know, constructing a factory in Mexico. But here you've got a case where the factory in Mexico is already built, and you've got Chrysler having made these internal decisions. And so then the argument is, do you undo that? And what's the impact on the company's bottom line? And it's an interesting debate.
And how persuasive and important are the arguments that Senators Cole and Feingold and other representatives will be making? I know they've been meeting with people in the Obama administration. Cole, as you quoted in your article yesterday, saying that their response was not good enough. What pull do they have here?
I think they have a limited amount of pull, just because it's not you're talking about Wisconsin, this is not necessarily an issue where they can bring other members from other states into play, and which points up an interesting political aspect of this, which is it's not just sort of Kenosha versus Mexico, it's also Kenosha versus Michigan, because it's not just a new plant in Mexico that's going to be producing this engine that Kenosha might have, you know, tried to compete for. It's also a new plant in Michigan. So, the International UAW sent a letter to members talking about both the GM and Chrysler rescue plans, and they were very critical of the GM rescue plan, but they didn't go out of their way to criticize the Chrysler plan, which I think, you know, underscores the difficulty here for, you know, Wisconsin having to make its case on its own for that plan.
Mm-hmm. Do you think this will change, or will it go through as planned, Craig?
I don't think it'll change.
Hmm. And we're also hearing about the possibility of GM. We've heard this for some months now, but it seems as though they may be going under perhaps sooner than we thought.
Well, I'm not an expert on that. I mean, I think I don't know what's going to happen there. I'm not sure I could give you a whole lot of insight on where GM is headed.
Yeah. We had the loss of more than 500,000 jobs last month, which is now being given this spin that, well, that's, you know, a good sign. It wasn't as many as we thought, but an unemployment rate of 8.9%, which is pretty darned high. Why are people seeing that as possibly a good sign? And I guess the second part of this question, which is broader, when are we as the American people and the administration going to say, hey, things are turning around, it's getting better?
Well, everything is compared to what? And, you know, if you're, you know, I think one thing politically that the Obama administration has benefited from is this, the kind of extremity of the crisis that they inherited. And so they've gotten some credit in a public relations sense from dodging, you know, the worst case scenario. And so, so again, that's where you sort of get this expectations mentality playing out. That's not, obviously doesn't buy them an infinite amount of time, but it does buy them some time. And if it buys them enough time to get to the point, which this is the second part of your question, to get to the point where there's enough of a sense of recovery in the making, then I think there will be some, you know, that cuts them a little bit of political slack.
Mm-hmm. Bob Herbert had an interesting column yesterday in the Times saying 7.8 million jobs would have to be created just to bring us back to where we were when the recession began.
Yeah, and then, you know, you think about the growth in the stock market that will have to occur just to make people whole again compared to where they were before the bottom fell out, and it's a similar equation.
Mm-hmm. A lot of people have lost a lot of money, haven't they?
Yeah, and again, if you're Obama and you're coming into you're beginning a presidency at this, you know, in the depths of economic disarray, then you know, there's good news and bad news for him politically, and the bad news is just the sheer extremity of the circumstances in which you're governing and the terrible situation you've inherited. But the good news is that, you know, people will judge you by, you know, against the situation you inherited. And in a sense, you've almost got nowhere to go but up.
Mm-hmm. Let's talk about health care for a moment. I know this is going to be flushed out some this morning, but the headlines today are, we've got the White House, we've got pharmaceutical groups, trade associations, other stakeholders in the health care debate, announcing a major effort today to streamline the nation's healthcare system that could save more than $2 trillion over the next decade. Do you have any idea what's up there?
You know, I was at a lunch last week, and our speaker was a former congressional aide who now has his own company. He's kind of a healthcare lobbyist, but a true expert on the policy and the politics of the situation. And he said, if you pick 20 people in Washington who just, you know, follow this issue professionally and are immersed in it, you know, maybe 2/3 of them would say that healthcare reform is going to happen, this year or in the next 2 years, which is pretty interesting because we've never really been in this situation before, at least not in recent times. So there's more of a sense of expectation about something major happening politically than there has been any other time I can remember in Washington. It's going to be a tremendous challenge to, you know, work out the details and make it happen politically. But we're in a much different place than we were 5 or 10 years ago on this issue.
Mm-hmm. So you see more. We've been talking about this, and you've been writing about it, I know, for years, and it affects so many people, small businesses and large businesses and people whose insurance is either lost or the cost is going up. We're finally at a moment where all those people are coming together who've had widely different views about what we should do concerning health care. They're going to agree on something?
Well, a lot of people have a stake in it. A lot of people have an interest in seeing it go forward. That doesn't mean that they're going to agree on the best way to do it. It means that the obstacles are not as daunting as they have been in the past. I can't tell you exactly what this plan is going to look like. The Obama administration has been content so far to kind of let Congress kind of carry the ball on this, but then at some point they will step in and try to shape the plan more aggressively. I mean, there obviously are some major sticking points when you talk about all the, quote, stakeholders on the issue, from organized labor to the business community, to advocacy groups, and people on both sides of the aisle. So it's not an easy lift at all.
Right. And yet they can probably do it, my understanding is, through reconciliation. So in case they don't have the 60 votes, they can make this happen.
Yeah, they kind of created this mechanism where they will try to get 60 votes, but there's a date in October that they set down as a marker. And if it hasn't happened by then under the 60 vote scenario, then they will do it, as you said, under what's called reconciliation, which basically allows you to do it with a simple majority instead of having to overcome a filibuster.
Mm-hmm. And what are your thoughts about those 60 votes? Do you think Franken will be seated? Do you think that battle's going on for some time, Craig?
It's hard to imagine it going on, you know, too much past this summer or fall. You know, there's a limit to, I think, how long the process can go on. I'm not on the ground in Minnesota, so I don't know how many more hoops they have to jump through for this to happen. I think that there's a pretty wide expectation in Washington that Al Franken is going to be the next senator from Minnesota. But the timing will be interesting.
Mm-hmm. I know you didn't have a chance to go, but the president was talking about a lot of things at the White House Correspondents Association dinner, ending on a serious note that the journalism profession is essential to our democracy, quoting Thomas Jefferson. We had hearings in the Senate yesterday about the future of journalism. Is this something else that the administration is going to have to jump in on? I know your profession and my profession are changing so radically, and we're worried about, you know, the loss of newspapers, and newspapers are going under. How involved is Washington in this?
Well, I don't sense that this is something that the administration is angling to get into. I think, you know, I'm not sure how, you know, what more you're going to see besides hearings. I mean, it's possible. There's been talk about some antitrust legislation and a few other things. But I think there's no obvious kind of legislative answer to this, or at least one that would have a dramatic impact on what newspapers are going through. I'd be surprised if there were any significant kind of government action on this. I think, you know, all things being equal, I think people in the political community would rather have newspapers than not have newspapers. But I'm not sure. You run into so many minefields when you start talking about the government taking proactive steps to bolster, you know, any industry, but particularly the newspaper industry, which plays this role as this sort of watchdog role.
Right.
It creates potential conflicts of interest. And also there's the sheer, you know, nature of the problem, of the economic problem that newspapers are facing, and the question of whether it really lends itself to a legislative solution or not. But it is, you know, it's on people's minds. I didn't go to that hearing last week that Senator Kerry held, but it's an interesting debate, and I'm not sure, but I don't see the Obama administration getting involved in a big way in that debate.
Craig Gilbert is our guest this hour for All Things Political. He is the Washington Bureau Chief for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel, and we're going to take some phone calls in just a moment. Our number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655, email address talk@wpr.org, and we'll be with you in just a moment on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. The second hour of our program this Monday, we will talk much more about the future of newspapers in this country. Our guest has written and delivered an interesting paper on a nonprofit model specifically for the New York Times. Our guest is the Knight Chair, Journalism and Digital Media Economics at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. All right, let's go to phone calls for Craig, starting with Ray from Milwaukee. Hello, Ray.
Hi, good morning, Kathleen, and to your guests. Your guest mentioned a moment ago that the plant in Mexico has already been built. Say that again?
Yes, our phone line is not terrific here, but mentioned that the
plant in Mexico has already been built, and that's the reason that we should send the jobs there. We as American taxpayers should be absolutely outraged. The plant in Kenosha has been standing for how many years, and they don't deserve their jobs? I mean, it reminds me of the Chinese when they would force a prisoner who was to be executed to pay for his own bullets. We need to stand up as Americans. We should all be outraged, and all of us should stand up with the workers of Kenosha. Maybe the state could take over the plant through eminent domain and start building generators for wind turbines there. I don't know, but we need to save our jobs here. And if we don't put that number one on the priority list, then the country is going down the drain.
Okay, Ray, I'd keep you on, but the phone line is terrible. Did you hear most of that, Craig?
Yeah, and I'm not saying the job should go there. I was just I was only making the point that the timing point, which is that the situation that the government and that Obama is looking at is one where you have a plant that the company has already invested in, and so it's I think it creates a different dilemma for them than if they had been presented with a Chrysler plan to go ahead and build a factory in Mexico from scratch rather than place the product, the engine line, in Kenosha. I'm just saying it's a different set of circumstances, a different set of facts, and it makes from a policy point of view, it creates a bigger dilemma for them. Whether the jobs should or shouldn't go there is somebody else's judgment to make.
What about his idea of the state should take over this plant and use it for power for wind generation in the state? Could something be done with that plant?
Well, I think there has been some discussion about, late last week you had, this isn't the wind power idea, but you did have members of Congress in Wisconsin talking about tapping this fund, which is meant to finance advanced technology cars and car components, and they were urging Chrysler to use this as a tool, as a financing tool to retool the Kenosha plant. That would be one possibility. Another possibility might be for a different company to come in and use the same funding mechanism to retool the Chrysler plant. Again, those would both be car projects. Whether there's a non-car use for the plant, I don't know. Mm-hmm. But I guess, I'm sure that people in Kenosha and the elected officials from Wisconsin will be looking into all those possibilities.
He used the term outrage, and I know there's outrage about a lot of different issues, but is that one of them, do you think, among the American people that we're more concerned now because the economy is in such terrible shape here about jobs being outsourced?
Sure. I think it was a big issue in the campaign. I mean,
right.
as we saw, you even had, Paul Ryan, who's the Republican congressman from the district that we're talking about and is a, pretty classic conservative on economic issues, ran a campaign ad in a race in which he was not seriously threatened, ran a campaign ad about trade that sort of could have been an ad run by a Democrat in terms of talking about insisting on fair trade and protecting American jobs, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So that's an indication, I think, of what's going on politically on the ground. People are really upset. I mean, this is a big issue, and it's a big issue. It was a big issue before the bottom fell out of the economy, and maybe a bigger issue now.
Let's go to Scott from DeForest. Hi, Scott.
Hi, folks. Thank you very much for the program. I have heard a very persuasive argument that what touched off this meltdown last year was the incredible run-up in the price of petroleum, and that people who were living on the fringes of big metropolitan areas, like, say, the outer suburbs of San Francisco Bay Area, were suddenly faced with incredible costs of gasoline on top of mortgages they were barely able to pay, and that what started the collapse. My question for you is, do you folks think, as seems to be the case, as I have seen now gas prices in the Madison, Dane County area run up 20 cents in this weekend alone, that the big oil companies and the oil speculators are going to kill this recovery in its crib the very same way they got the recession rolling for us last year?
That's an interesting question.
I don't know the answer to that.
Yeah. They sure did go up 20 cents in a couple days here in the Milwaukee area. There's no, and our response was, well, it's spring. Of course.
But, I mean, it, you know, we're obviously the fact that, I mean, the fall in the price of gasoline was one, you know, one piece of good news amid a lot of terrible news in terms of the state of the economy. Now, whether the, whether, I mean, if the price were to go, were to climb back up again to where it was before, that would obviously be a huge, you know, obstacle in terms of getting the economy revved up again.
Yeah. Thank you, Scott, very much for your call. Let's go to Ann from Madison next. Hi, Ann. Oh, did I do this right? There we go. Hi, Ann. We didn't hear you. Yeah. Okay.
Okay. There's an echo in this phone, and there often is. As long as Obama and members of Congress surround themselves and take huge amounts of money from these companies on Wall Street and elsewhere who have made so much money in this bailout that Wall Street engineered, we're not going to have any relief, I don't think. And for the Chrysler plant, the people who worked there and the managers were told that that plant would stay open. And apparently, while they were being told that, Chrysler was building a plant to replace it in Mexico. So they absolutely flat out lied, which seems to me to be, you know, a possible cause for a serious lawsuit. And I'm just so surprised that after getting what was supposed to be a loan, all from the average taxpayer, that loan has now been converted into a gift, and the gift is being used to move to Mexico. And I'm sure, you know, when Mexico gets too expensive for Chrysler, they'll move to Indonesia or somewhere. The whole thing is such a fraud.
Craig.
Well, this, I think, is kind of right on the point of why this is such a difficult issue for the Obama administration, because once they, you know, essentially become a part owner of Chrysler and start making decisions about Chrysler's future, they kind of inherit all the baggage of that, which in this case includes Kenosha. There has been, you know, a big issue about how truthful and open Chrysler has been about this. I mean, Chrysler has written letters to elected officials in Wisconsin saying, you know, in some cases apologizing for misleading them in recent conversations, but also sort of defending their decision not to announce Kenosha's fate earlier in the process because they argued it was part of a restructuring that hadn't been approved yet and may or may not be approved by the government. So, but that along with everything else, one of the issues on the table has been, you know, the credibility and truthfulness of the different players in all this, and on top of just the, you know, the upset over the outcome.
Would you do a follow-up, Ann?
Well, I just think, you know, I'm afraid that Obama couldn't have been elected unless this was the kind of policy he was going to support. This campaign went on for 2 years, and I think the reason it did, and people like Kucinich were prevented from participating in the public discussions, was I don't think any man or woman could be elected in the United States president at this point who wasn't willing to be pushed around by corporate power. And I think this is really, it's going to destroy us.
Thanks for the call, Ann. We have some lines open now if you'd like to join our conversation. It's All Things Political for this Monday. Craig Gilbert is our guest. He's the Washington Bureau Chief for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. And we're covering, well, we've been on national issues specifically and particularly strong, the Chrysler situation. But there are also things going on internationally. So we'll talk about Pakistan here in a moment. But wherever you'd like to guide us, our number, 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. If you'd like to send an email, that address is talk@WPR.org, talk@WPR.org. It seems to me as though the president, and I know he's often talked about Pakistan and the Taliban, but now we've got, you know, the situation is just growing more and more worrisome as the Taliban is moving more into Pakistan's settled areas. And the president did meet with the president of Pakistan and in Afghanistan last week. How concerned is he about this, about whether or not Pakistan will remain viable, Craig?
And it's a huge concern. I mean, Pakistan is really kind of shot to the top of everyone's list in terms of foreign policy concerns. It's always been there, but instead of sort of seeing Pakistan as, you know, kind of related to the issue of Afghanistan, I think now policymakers see it as more important, and they see sort of Afghanistan more through the lens of how does it affect Pakistan. So you've got, you know, the issue of how does what we do in Afghanistan affect the Taliban and the insurgents in Pakistan? How does our policy toward Pakistan help or hurt Pakistan's ability to fend off that challenge? I mean, Dick Cheney was on one of the Sunday shows on Sunday, and he was asked about this, and he said that the good news was that there was a time when the Pakistan government didn't see Al-Qaeda and the Taliban as a threat to itself, but saw it as an issue, as kind of an Afghanistan issue, and they didn't take it as seriously in terms of their own existence, and now they do. I guess you could say that's good news. I guess you could say it's good news if the Taliban and Al-Qaeda are alienating the population of Pakistan the way they did in Iraq before the Anbar Awakening. But obviously, the situation over there is just, you know, kind of red hot. And because of Pakistan's status as a nuclear power, is just, you know, probably the number one kind of nightmare scenario in terms of foreign policy for the government, for our government.
What was the story? Was it last week or the week before that more money was approved for taking care of the country, for taking care of services in that country, basic services that don't seem to be being met? Wasn't there a huge loan that was approved by Congress?
For Pakistan?
Yes.
Well, we've been, you know, I'm not sure about the specific story you're referring to, but, you know, we've been obviously been sending a lot of money over there for some time now. And, you know, the mix of the mix of resources, when you compare, for example, what we had been spending in Iraq to what we're spending in Afghanistan and Pakistan, has certainly shifted a lot over the last several years. And now Pakistan and Afghanistan are really more, I think, the centerpiece than Iraq was.
You mentioned Dick Cheney. He's just popping up all over the place now. And from a guy who was so secretive for so many years, two questions. One is, why is he popping up all over the place? And two, are the Republicans happy that he's the guy who's becoming the answer man to the administration?
I don't think the Republicans are politically necessarily happy if Dick Cheney is seen, or Rush Limbaugh for that matter, is seen as the face of the Republican Party. Dick Cheney says he's speaking out because, and I don't doubt this, he has very pronounced and strong and deeply held views about national security policy, and particularly, you know, interrogations, Guantanamo, terrorist surveillance, and this is an area I don't think he's upset about some of the foreign policy decisions the Obama administration has made about Iraq and Afghanistan, but I think he's, you know, apoplectic about on these issues of torture and Guantanamo and detainee policies, and he sees this as sort of the undoing of a whole bunch of steps that, in his mind, the government took that bolstered that made the country safer after 9/11. A view that's obviously challenged by many Democrats, but these are the issues he cares about, and so he sees his policies being undone, or these policies being undone. And then he also, you know, is reading about the possibility of pursuing, you know, sanctions or prosecutions against some of the people involved in these policies. And so I think, I don't have any doubt that that's the reason why he's speaking out.
Yeah. I'm just trying to remember, and there must be some time in American history where the former vice president, who was in office for 8 years, becomes the voice of opposition.
Yeah, I don't think it's happened
in recent time. It hasn't, has it?
No.
Just seems unusual.
And it's also obviously in stark contrast to the silence that the former president,
right,
George W. Bush, has pursued.
Yeah. Let's go to Steve from Rice Lake next. Hi, Steve.
Good morning. You passed through the health care discussion without, and I take offense at it, without mentioning the systematic exclusion of the single-payer advocates from that discussion, including President Obama's personal physician, who was in favor of that. And humbly suggest that as WPR, during the build-up to the Iraq invasion, had several experts on discounting the myth of WMD, I think it would be really appropriate for WPR at this stage to have on several advocates of single-payer health care.
Well, just to defend ourselves, we've had a lot of discussions of health care, single-payer among them, but we can certainly, and we do cover this issue pretty frequently. Would you agree with him, Craig, that single-payer is something that's not being discussed in Washington?
Well, it's not getting a lot of attention right now because it's not the approach that's being pushed by the administration, for one thing. And so if you don't have the support of a Democratic president for that option, and if you've got kind of a mixed bag even within the Democratic Party on the Hill, then you know it's created this expectation that it's just not going to happen, and that's just that's just a reflection of the political reality of who's advocating and who isn't advocating a single-payer system. That's separate from the merits, obviously the substantive merits of the issue, which obviously deserve debate.
Right. And I guarantee you we will have many more shows on that very subject, Steve. Thank you for your call. Jason from Kenosha is next. Hi, Jason.
Hi. I just wanted to mention that the investment company that owns Chrysler, that's a private company, and I don't really see how the government has an interest in working with that company if they aren't going to be concerned about the jobs. I mean, if it's a private company, what interest does the government have in saving the company if they're not going to be worried about the jobs? And also, you know, that company has been involved in job losses in northern Wisconsin with paper mills. They've got their hands in the financing problem with both Chrysler and General Motors. I just think they're causing a lot of problems, much more than they're probably worth.
Well, I think that certainly jobs certainly is the rationale for the government intervening in this whole situation. And I think the administration would argue that by intervening, they are preserving jobs. Now, Kenosha aside, that clearly would be the public rationale for spending taxpayer money in doing this is to preserve jobs. And a lot of those jobs that in theory are being preserved are American jobs. But then when you get down to the details of what's happening to particular facilities in particular states like Kenosha was one of eight, by the way, that are slated to be closed under this restructuring, then that's where it gets really sticky.
Unless there's more, Jason? Thanks very much for the call. Mike from Appleton is next. Hello, Mike.
Yeah, let me push it back into the international arena. A comment and then a question. Comment about Pakistan. You know, I really don't think anything's going to happen in Pakistan. I think the military is too strong. And I think what they're doing is, you know, they're going to let it go to the brink, and then some general is going to come in and be the savior. And then everybody's going to be happy with that general. My question for your guest is with regards to Iran. I just wonder, do we really think that Israel is just sitting there, you know, twiddling their thumbs while Iran gets closer and closer to having a nuclear weapon, or are they going to do something?
Well, that's an excellent question. And some people who would like to see, some people who might favor, taking action, military action against Iran, kind of see Israel as, kind of the actor of last resort that, you know, well, if the U.S. doesn't do it, Israel will do it because it's really Israel's existence that's at stake. I don't know whether that's the correct way to look at it or not. I do know that for the U.S., intervening and trying to take out Iran's nuclear capacity is obviously a hugely risky and complicated scenario where, even under the Bush administration, there were a lot of people that were extremely reluctant to do that, even though some people perceived the Bush administration as kind of angling for a fight with Iran. There's a military problem in terms of what you can, whether such a strike would even accomplish its purposes before you even consider the political fallout. And that's why Iran has been such a dilemma for people. Israel obviously did that in the case of Iraq in the early 80s and took out a nuclear facility in Iraq. And at the time, the U.S. government, was extremely critical of Israel, even though later a lot of people in the U.S. government were glad that Israel did it. But that was a much simpler and easier task militarily than what we're talking about in the case of Iran.
Craig Gilbert is our guest for All Things Political this Monday, and we'll take more phone calls in a moment. Our number, 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. You can send an email if you would like. I don't think anybody's used that yet today, but feel free, talk@WPR.org. I'm Kathleen Dunn. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. The second hour of our program today, we talk with the Knight Chair in Journalism and Digital Media at the University of North Carolina about the future of the New York Times and other newspapers in this country. All right, two phone calls, more of them for Craig Gilbert, 800-486-8655. Rich from Rhinelander is next. Hello, Rich.
Thanks. I believe that a country, a nation is never stronger than when it has good jobs for its people and a strong economy. Without that, you can't even have a proper national defense or military. And I grew up in an era where I was told we had to defeat communism. And while I wasn't the most virulent anti-communist, I knew I wouldn't survive 6 weeks under a communist regime. They would have had me before a firing squad for lipping off. But what happened over the last several decades is corporations in America decided that they had to chase cheap labor wherever and for whatever it would bring. Last time I checked, Vietnam and China are still communist nations. Last time I checked, we're bailing out the people who came up with these policies that basically created a wage and benefit crisis among the salary crisis among the American people. And so I want to hear someone speak to the point of deglobalization, the idea that it is not unintelligent, it is not wrong to say shipping your work overseas to everyone else other than your own people is unpatriotic. I think some people need to be brought up on charges for basically feeding us a bill of goods, saying one time we had to defeat communism, now we have to be sure that China stays strong. I don't get it. Maybe Mr. Gilbert does, but I don't get it.
Well, I think that's the debate we've been having, and that's the debate we're having right now. I mean, that was the NAFTA debate, right? And you've got, on the one side, you've got an argument that, which is sort of the argument the caller's been making, that we're not doing nearly enough to preserve these jobs, and that the trade policies we've been pursuing are way too liberal in the classic economic sense, that they don't provide the kind of protections that are required to keep to support things like manufacturing employment in the U.S. And on the other side, you've got an argument that quote, protectionist trade policies are destructive, not just to other countries, but to ourselves, and that the only real, that the right remedy or the right policy to pursue in light of that is to take advantage of our, higher levels of education and innovation and pursue development policies that build off of that. And that's the debate we've been having now for a long time.
Thanks, Rich, very much for your call. Andrew is next from Verona. Hello, Andrew.
Hello.
Hi.
I noticed last week that there was some naming and shaming going on about the senior bondholders in the Chrysler deal that weren't willing to go along with the quick bankruptcy proposal that had been put out. And I'm wondering what the ripple effects of that might be. At the same time, we're really hoping that all types of investors will step up and be putting money, hopefully not taxpayer money, but investment money, into the system if we're kind of pulling the rug out from under the what was a very well-established system for in bankruptcy procedures and how troubled companies' assets are handled.
Well, this is a little bit outside of my area of expertise. There has been a debate going on, which, you know, in recent months about whether people in the financial community and investors are being sort of stigmatized in this whole process in a way that's harmful to investment. And I don't know the answer to that, but I've heard that argument made.
Thank you very much for your call. Supreme Court nominee, how soon can we expect a nomination from the president, and how do you think he's going to go about the deliberation process, Craig?
Well, I would be surprised if we didn't know, certainly by the end. I would think we'd know by the end of May. The only reason I say that is because this is something that they've been thinking about ever since they took office and before Obama took office, that this is a subject that obviously the president is engaged in. He's a former, you know, professor of constitutional law. He's got a vice president who's managed or sat through the confirmation process for all but one of the sitting nine justices. And so I would expect it to happen pretty quickly. And it's going to be a revealing choice because the Democrats hold all the political cards. And so he has the ability, if he wants to make a pretty aggressive choice to pick somebody. He doesn't have to sort of toe the line and find the most centrist jurist that he could possibly find in order to get through the confirmation process, because he has he probably has enough votes in the Senate to get someone confirmed who doesn't fit that description. On the other hand, you know, temperamentally, he sort of sent signals that he's trying to avoid the most hot button choice he could pick. And so a lot of people expect him to pick somebody that will be, while this person will be opposed by conservatives, won't be regarded as the worst possible choice by conservatives. So that, you know, people are going to read a lot into his selection.
And do you hear names being tossed about, or is
that?
Yeah,
there's a lot of names being tossed about. Most of them, I guess the main thing about that is that most people expect him to pick a woman, because, you know, it's only one woman on the court, and there's also an expectation that he may pick either an African American or a Latino or a Latina for that position. Again, you know, create a more diverse court. We don't know if he's going to do that, but that's certainly one of the expectations at play. And so when you sort of, if you start from that premise, there's a fairly short list of names that, you know, that pop up, including Diane Wood, who's on the Seventh Circuit in Chicago, who I believe served at the University of Chicago Law School with Obama. Solicitor General Elena Kagan is already part of the administration. You've heard names of even a couple of, I should say one cabinet secretary, Janet Napolitano, the Homeland Security Secretary, and also Michigan Governor Jennifer Granholm. So those are some of the names that come up.
Mm-hmm. There's so much going on in this administration, isn't there? It just seems like every day there's huge news.
Yeah, now that was my reaction when we heard the Souter announcement about the court vacancy. That was the only thing that was missing at this point. You know, with everything that's happening abroad, everything that's happening in the economy, now they're taking on the biggest domestic policy issue out there, which is health care. And on top of all that, now, you know, a Supreme Court nomination.
Right.
It's odd that you could have a circumstance where you could have a Supreme Court nomination fight, which isn't the all-consuming political issue of the day, which is kind of an interesting way to look at it, because every time in the recent past that's happened, it's just sort of taken over the conversation.
Yeah. In some ways, it seems like he's been in office for a long period of time, and it hasn't been. Does it feel that way to you?
Yeah, absolutely. I was thinking the other day about, you know, the Bush presidency seems very far away right now. And, you know, I guess it's, you know, you can, the fact that Dick Cheney's out there as present as he is, but George W. Bush is kind of receded from memory, I think underscores that. But it does seem like they've been in office a long time. And also, you know, it's the combination, I think, of everything that's on the plate, everything that's happening right now, and also just the kind of velocity of politics and information these days, that it always creates a sense that, you know, something, we go through so many news cycles that something that happened 7 days ago suddenly feels like it happened a month ago. And the Obama presidency, which is only, what, 100 and something days old, feels like it's like a lot more time has passed.
Right. In a way, I think that's unfortunate, because you want time to think about all of these issues, and instead you're on to something else the next day. Or
just imagine what the challenge is politically for the administration.
Right.
I imagine it can work both for and against them, but just the ability to, I think one thing that Obama's done in the first 100 and so days is that, you know, he's at least created a perception on the part of a majority of people in opinion polls that he's up to the job. And that wasn't a given, given his level of experience coming in. It was certainly a question in some people's minds. And so you have to obviously master the art of managing the information flow and on a daily basis, and as well as just crisis management, with enough skill that you come across to people, appear to people to be a functional executive.
Right. Who do you think have been the most effective members of his cabinet, Craig?
Well, again, speaking of, you know, going on a short period of time here, I think certainly I would say the Defense Secretary Gates has been, you know, there was obviously some continuity there, picking somebody who had served in the last administration, I think sort of projects a certain amount of confidence. I think obviously the biggest set of questions have swirled around the Treasury Secretary, Tim Geithner.
Yes.
And I think Napolitano has the president's confidence. I'm not sure any of these people have been, you know, really, really severely tested yet, so it's kind of a tricky question to answer.
Mm-hmm. Well, Napolitano was certainly put into a position she didn't think that she was going to have to handle with the swine flu, right? Didn't have their person in place.
Right, and fortunately that appears to be not the crisis that we thought it might be.
Right. Let's go to Carl from Peshtigo next. Hi, Carl.
Thank you, Kathleen.
Yes, certainly, Carl.
Yes. In regards to the George Bush administration, George Bush, was he the acting president in regards to what Dick Cheney is beating his drums over of George Bush's administration? My question, what is Dick Cheney's agenda for beating the drums as well as he is and so forth, and what is it going to context to and constitute?
You mean, what's Dick Cheney up to?
Sure. Take
well,
that one.
Think, you know, you can answer that question a couple of different ways. I said this before, but I do think these are policy issues that he has a stake in, that he feels really strongly about. And so he's just sort of defending the policies that he had a big hand in crafting. I don't think the answer is purely political. On the other hand, you know, there is an argument that will be ongoing about an historical argument about their policies, about the war in Iraq, about the anti-terrorist policies, and I think he's interested in making his case for the history books as well as making his case for policy.
Okay, I got one more question.
All right, it has to be quick. We're almost out of time.
If he's so much regards for waterboarding, why don't they volunteer themselves? Mr. Bush and Mr. Cheney. We'll take waterboarding, and you can see if we can get the answers out of them.
All right. Thanks very much for the call, Carl. Craig, thank you so much for being with us. Always a pleasure, and carry on. Got a lot of work to do, huh?
Anytime.
All right, thanks. Craig Gilbert, our guest this hour for our usual Monday morning All Things Political segment. He is the Washington Bureau Chief for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel and wrote a piece, in case you missed it yesterday, the front page story on being under fire, the president, for job losses and the outrage and anguish over Chrysler's decision to close its 800-employee Kenosha engine plant as it opens a similar factory in Mexico, and this business about taxpayer money, $12 billion, no small amount, to help restructure. Well, thanks to Rhonda Fanning for producing this hour. Thanks to Rob Schroeder for on-air production here in our Milwaukee studios. And thanks, everybody, for all of your calls. We have news coming up in just a moment from National Public Radio, and we'll continue. We spent a few minutes talking about newspapers. We'll talk a lot more about newspapers and their future, and particularly the New York Times. All of that will be coming up in just a moment. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.